I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor, as today we talk about the management of triple-negative breast cancer with Dr. Aditya Bardia from the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. We have a great faculty for this series, and later on we'll show you a survey we did of the faculty of their usual treatment patterns. And as always, we have a number of docs who are going to be presenting cases briefly from their practices, mostly general medical oncologists, but also Dr. Matani, who's a clinical investigator. Here's where we're heading. We're going to chat a little bit about the biology of triple-negative breast cancer. Then we'll do the case presentations, and then we'll go through the survey, and then do the journal club with Dr. Bardi. If you want to download the slides, we also have Module 5, which is really an appendix. But before we get started, as always, we always get cases sent in. We're about to do these things. Aditya, I want to just run one by you. I got an email from Dr. Francis Cuevas. Here it is, right off the top, just to get warmed up. Here's his case. This is an actual patient that he treated in his practice. 40 years old, BRCA1 mutation, presumably germline. 4 years ago, she had stage 1 triple-negative breast cancer, gets pre-op ACT, double mastectomy, path CR. Now it's 4 years later, she has metastatic disease, lung mets, pleural effusion, pretty symptomatic, and the PD-L1 assay is pending. So the question is, she's got this pleural-based mass causing pain, short of breath, the patient. What should be first-line therapy, and how would you bring a PARP inhibitor into this patient's treatment? Would you include it as part of your first-line strategy or hold off? And Aditya, how would it change whether she's PD-1 positive or negative?
Yeah, and a good question about the first-line therapy for a patient with metastatic TNBC who also has germline BRCA mutation. In my own practice, I like to check for two things in a patient who has metastatic TNBC. The first is look at PD-L1, and that's based on the CPS score. In the past, we were also doing SP140, but now with the approval of pembrolizumab, which is the only FDA-approved immunotherapy option approved for patients with metastatic TNBC, I tend to look at CPS. And the second is, if a patient does not have known BRCA status, checking for germline BRCA. So for this patient with germline BRCA, options would include chemotherapy, platinum, other chemotherapy agents. It's been more than 4 years out, so one could use taxanes again, plus minus checkpoint inhibition. Usually we get the results of PD-1 in time to make a therapeutic decision. And if this patient has PD-L1 positive tumor, I would lean towards starting immunotherapy plus chemotherapy, such as carboplatin. So carboplatin plus pembro would be the preferred first line for this patient. And the reason I like to use immunotherapy first is because A, there's an overall survival advantage with immunotherapy, something we've not seen with PARP inhibitors. And second, they tend to work better in earlier lines than later lines. Now, after disease progression on first-line therapy, in the second-line and beyond setting, I would feel comfortable using a PARP inhibitor.
So monotherapy for PARP inhibitor in a patient who's PD-1 negative?
If it's PD-1 negative, then it's a discussion whether the patient should be considered for carboplatin alone or an oral agent like PARP inhibitor. If the patient does not have a strong preference of IV versus oral, I would tend to use chemotherapy first, like carboplatin, and then save PARP inhibitor for second line and beyond.
What's your preference for which PARP inhibitor?
I think both olaparib and talazoparib are good agents. If you look at the data, the improvement in progression-free survival hazard ratio very similar. The side effects are slightly different. Talazoparib is a much more potent PARP inhibitor, also causes PARP trapping. So myelosuppression is slightly more with talazoparib. Olaparib tends to cause more GI side effects like nausea, but it's a very minor difference. So I feel comfortable using either.
So we've got another case that came up a couple hours ago. I was actually doing one of these videos I do to capture cases with Dr. Namrata Paswani from UT Southwestern in Richardson, Texas. And she had a case. We're going to present in a future thing, but it was so compelling. And also she wanted an answer. So audience, I want you to listen to this. Here's the situation. This is another first-line metastatic disease, Dr. Bardia. This is a patient previously treated with neoadjuvant therapy, now has metastatic disease. And the problem is this patient has a history of multiple sclerosis and rheumatoid arthritis, both. Neither are currently being treated. So my question is, and I'm going to ask the audience, yes or no, you have a patient, first-line metastatic disease, but she has this history of MS and RA currently not being treated and asymptomatic. Would you add, would you include an IO, pembrolizumab, for example, with chemotherapy, yes or no? Almost two-thirds say they would. What do you think, Aditya?
Well, this is tough. It looks like you know, I have to make a decision. For this patient, I think the details would be important in terms of how long ago the MS was, and even in terms of rheumatoid arthritis when that was. I'm less concerned about rheumatoid arthritis because in a worst case scenario, could be patient has a flare of rheumatoid arthritis or, you know, other problems related to rheumatoid arthritis, but those can be managed with medications. And many times we use chemotherapy, methotrexate, for rheumatoid arthritis. But it's the multiple sclerosis that's concerning. And if this is a recent diagnosis, that would be of concern and might want to start with chemo first, at least for the first couple of cycles, ensure there are no problems and at least the chemo portion is set. And then you can add the checkpoint inhibition.
So actually, I was going to, Dr. Paswani asked me another question, and I was based on a case, and I was going to bring it up later, but I see Alan in the chat room already brought it up. I think this is maybe the number one question in triple negative breast cancer right now, Aditya. In the chat room, the question is, patients with triple negative breast cancer are in the middle of neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Can you add an IO? Is it reasonable if they're on their last dose of chemo? Could you add an IO? And the real question, this is what Dr. Paswani brought up, because she had a patient who just finished neoadjuvant chemo. Any thoughts, assuming if you could access it, Dr. Bardia, of just using adjuvant IO in that situation, pembro?
It's a discussion, but I would definitely consider that. It's a data-free zone. Having said that, we only have one shot at the goal in the early breast cancer setting to prevent recurrence. And the data with immunotherapy in the neoadjuvant adjuvant setting are quite compelling. And the way KEYNOTE-522 was designed, it's impossible to differentiate the adjuvant versus the neoadjuvant contribution with immunotherapy. So if a patient is on neoadjuvant chemotherapy or has completed neoadjuvant chemotherapy, I would consider immunotherapy provided you know, it's right for the patient. Patient has high-risk disease, someone with lymph node positive disease where you're really worried about recurrence. I would definitely discuss that with the patient.
Patient with residual disease after neoadjuvant therapy, and then what do you do about the capecitabine? Do you give both?
So it depends on the amount of residual disease. We have data from CREATEX, which has shown that patients who have residual disease, if they get capecitabine, there's benefit in terms of reducing recurrence. And we have data from KEYNOTE-522, where patients who got adjuvant immunotherapy and who had residual disease, there was benefit. And if you look at the curves, it's really this residual disease setting where you see a clear separation of the curves. I would definitely consider immunotherapy. For a patient with RCB 2 or 3, young patient, someone that I'm really concerned about, I would definitely consider capecitabine plus immunotherapy. We have safety data that we can combine these two agents, so I would feel comfortable doing that.
So Parvin in the chat room says, you know, sort of layering on top of this neoadjuvant discussion, patients who are BRCA. So how do you factor in, you've got a patient who's got a BRCA germline mutation, you're going to give them neoadjuvant chemo therapy plus pembro, what do you think about in terms of bringing in, you know, an Olympia flare here?
Yeah, so we'll be combining Olympia and KEYNOTE-522 for this patient. We know that patients who have BRCA mutation, they derive benefit from immunotherapy. So I would definitely want to keep immunotherapy for that patient. And rather than capecitabine for this patient, I would actually prefer olaparib. So I would do olaparib plus immunotherapy in the adjuvant setting for a patient with germline BRCA mutation.
So the audience knows that if they start out a question with 94-year-old, I'm always going to bring it up. So Venue has a 94-year-old a woman with a 3-centimeter triple-negative breast cancer, node negative, who went to surgery. So she's post-op, status post-radiation. Any role for adjuvant pembro in this 94-year-old, Dr. Bardia?
Yeah, it's a completely data-free zone. In part, I guess it would depend. Is it a healthy 94-year-old, more like a 84-year-old, 94-year-old? Was it someone who has a lot of comorbid illnesses, autoimmune conditions? If the patient does have a lot of comorbid conditions, particularly autoimmune conditions, I would be worried about the use of just adjuvant immunotherapy. We don't have data in the adjuvant setting yet, but if you look at the metastatic setting, where immunotherapy as a single agent was compared against chemotherapy, there was really no improvement in progression-free survival or overall survival. So not really sure in terms of how immunotherapy alone would impact the disease trajectory for this elderly patient. So it's very important that we don't cause immunotherapy-related toxicity in this patient.
Let me just roll something back, though, because I just want to be clear. So if she were, 65 or 70, status post-surgery, 3 centimeter node negative, what would you be thinking about including pembro in her adjuvant therapy?
No, because we don't have data in this setting for someone who is 65 or 70-year-old with 3 centimeter tumor lymph node negative. I would consider adjuvant chemotherapy, the standard being ACT for that patient.
Okay, well, before we get into more cases, I just want to take a breath and I want to bring up a paper that you did that I thought was really helpful. I highly recommend it to people. It's a JNCCN overview of novel agents in metastatic triple negative breast cancer. I love the title, Finding the Positive in the Negative. And it's thankfully, we really do have a lot more, and we're doing spending a whole hour on triple negative today. So thankfully, we have more to talk about than we did 3 or 4 years ago. I always love these diagrams. I thought this was very effective. Can you just chat a little bit about your vision of some of the key interesting biology of triple negative breast cancer and some of the novel targets and novel agents that are being looked at?
Yeah, this review paper was actually inspired by a patient. We had a patient a few years ago with triple negative breast cancer, and we were talking about treatment options. And I was explaining that you have triple negative breast cancer. And the question was, what do you mean triple negative? What's negative? I'm sure there must be something positive in the tumor that you can target, which got us thinking that we call it triple negative breast cancer because it's negative for ERP or HER2, but there are actionable targets in triple negative breast cancer. And that was the focus of this paper, talking about the positive and the negative. We're talking about actionable targets in triple negative breast cancer. And if you look at actionable targets, we can broadly divide them into 3 big buckets. The first being antigens that are targets of antibody drug conjugates, example being TROP2. We have an ADC, sacituzumab govitecan, that's FDA approved, and it targets TROP2, an antigen that's overexpressed in triple negative breast cancer. And there are other antibody drug conjugates in development as well. So these antibody drug conjugates that target antigens that are overexpressed in triple negative breast cancer essentially represent an actionable target. The second would be immunotherapy, be it PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors. These target something that's present in the tumor or the tumor microenvironment. And then the third, the traditional thinking of either mutations or signaling pathways, example being the PI3 kinase, AKT, mTOR signaling pathway. That's really not panned out yet in triple negative breast cancer. The last big trial, the Opportunity, was negative, which looked at ipatasertib plus chemotherapy for PI3 kinase altered triple negative breast cancer. But I think we still need to do more work. And there's definitely a subset of triple negative breast cancer that could be targeted with these signaling or tyrosine kinase inhibitors. So that essentially was the focus of this paper, that we should start looking at actionable targets in triple negative breast cancer. And maybe we need to, in the future, redefine the terminology of triple negative breast cancer.
So I'm kind of wondering whether the terminology you for breast cancer is about to change, because I'm going to suggest another possible target or another type subset under triple negative. I'm curious what your thoughts are. I was mentioning this audio program I did with Dr. Kropp. We spent 2 hours talking about HER2 low breast cancer, if you can believe it. But what about HER2 low triple negative breast cancer?
Oh, absolutely. That's a great point. And at ASCO, this year, we saw data with HER2 ADC, trastuzumab deruxtecan, in combination with immunotherapy with Durva, and very impressive response rates with the combination of this HER2 ADC for the HER2 low triple negative breast cancer. So I think that would probably redefine triple negative breast cancer. And even now one can make a case. So if you call PD-L1 positive tumors, PD-L1 positive triple negative breast cancer, what should PD-L1 negative triple negative breast cancer be called? Maybe quaternary negative breast cancer. So we're already challenging the definition of triple negative breast cancer, but as we have these additional targets, I foresee the classification will change.
Yeah, and then you've got BRCA too. This is starting to sound like lung cancer. You know, the lung cancer thing went from like algorithm with like three things on it to about 50 things on it. You know, it's interesting, you know, HER2 low, maybe we'll talk about it a little bit later, because that also comes up when people, you know, start out HER2 positive, then they become HER2 negative. And Dr. Hamilton was on our series recently, Erica Hamilton was talking about that. And I asked her what's happening coming up at San Antonio that everybody ought to be aware of. And the first thing she brought up is your presentation. And sorry, I know this is triple negative, but I think this is maybe going to be one of the practice-changing presentations at San Antonio on the oral SERD, the phase 3 trial. Can you just sort of give us a brief on what you can tell us about that, and what do you think the outcome is going to be?
You know, great timing, because just today the company had a press release on the Emerald trial. So as a brief background, Emerald trial is a phase 3 global trial looking at an oral SERD elacestrant versus standard of care endocrine therapy, fulvestrant or aromatase inhibitor, in the second, third line setting for patients with hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer. So a common scenario in clinic being someone with hormone receptor positive metastatic breast cancer gets an aromatase inhibitor plus a CDK4/6 inhibitor in the first line, then has disease progression. And usually in the second line, we tend to use fulvestrant. So the study was asking the question, can we compare an oral SERD that might be a oral and potentially more potent than fulvestrant or other standard endocrine therapy in this setting? And as per the press release announced today, the trial was positive. It met its primary endpoint, and the primary endpoint was statistically significant. We've not seen the full data yet, so stay tuned at San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium on Wednesday, which is the 8th of December in the morning. The results of Emerald would be presented.
So, you know, until Erica brought that up to me, I wasn't really expecting it to be better. I was just thinking, okay, they don't have to get injections, it'll be oral. But she was bringing up the fact that you can use higher doses, and we've always known there was a dose. Do you think that is the biologic explanation of why this trial is positive?
Yeah, in preclinical models, the drug elacestrant is more potent than fulvestrant. So the idea is not just to have an oral fulvestrant, but a better and more potent fulvestrant. And we've seen it with other oral degraders as well. Giredestrant by Genentech, amcenestrant by Sanofi. These are all oral SERDs, which in preclinical models have shown efficacy that's higher than fulvestrant. So we're really looking for a better endocrine agent, which is also oral.
Raji in the chat room wants to know, can you use an oral SERD in somebody who progresses on fulvestrant?
So the Emerald trial did allow patients who had received prior fulvestrant, they could receive aromatase inhibitor as the standard therapy. So subset analysis comparing elacestrant versus aromatase inhibitor would be interesting.
So one more non-triple negative thing I have to ask you about, because everybody's asking me about it. And you're involved in everything here, it seems like. So you did the discussion of the adjuvant Abema ESMO paper, was it last week? I know it was in the last couple of weeks that Joyce O'Shaughnessy presented. And people are asking me how to interpret the FDA approval statement. So maybe you can give us a little input on that. The thing that I find confusing, if you actually look at the indication, Ki-67 over 20%, we can talk about that, and that's a whole other issue. But what confuses a lot of people, including me, is it just says high risk. Everybody interprets that to mean the criteria of the trial, which are in the indication. Is that what they mean, or can you do it for what you consider high risk?
You know, it's a very good question, something that was discussed quite extensively last week internally with the steering committee members and, you know, other members, just to have a good understanding of what the FDA approval essentially is. There are three components related to the FDA approval of adjuvant abemaciclib. The first one is for patients with lymph node positive, hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative breast cancer. The second is Ki-67 of 20% or higher. And the third is high risk of recurrence, which as per the trial was defined by clinical pathological features in cohort one of MONARCH-E. And that essentially includes either patients who have four or more positive lymph nodes, or those with one to three positive lymph nodes who also have grade three tumors or tumor size of more than 5 centimeters. So technically all these three conditions need to be met as per FDA approval. Now, for an individual patient, we can always consider things off label, but if you're purely going by the label, it has these three conditions: lymph node positive, Ki-67 of 20% or higher, and third, high risk as per clinical pathological features.
So we'll talk about that more with Dr. Goetz, but you know, I guess one of the issues here is the downsides, and this is not chemo. You know, it's an oral agent that's not usually life-threatening and you can stop. So you know, kind of, I'd be real curious to see how this plays out in clinical practice and discussions with patients. But again, we'll talk about that more in our next MTP ER positive. Let's get into some cases though. We're gonna start out with a patient of Dr. Deborah Pat. This is a young woman, 40 years old. Here's Dr. Pat describing her questions about this case.
The first question that I would ask is, are there optimal breast imaging strategies when mammography is normal? She came with a very large mass and obviously a very high-risk cancer. And I think, like many young women, frequently have mammography that's dense and difficult to evaluate. A second interesting question in this patient who came back with a biopsy positive triple negative breast cancer is optimal strategies for neoadjuvant therapy in patients with triple negative breast cancer and locally advanced disease. Is there an opportunity to apply the KEYNOTE-522 data and think about immunotherapy in combination with carboplatin, paclitaxel, and Adriamycin, Cytoxan? A third question, both in this patient who has very high-risk disease and more broadly among patients that have either T2 node positive, triple negative breast cancer, or four or more lymph nodes positive with ER positive and HER2 negative breast cancer. What is the role of genetic testing and what implications can that have for potential therapeutic options in the adjuvant setting?
So I think we talked about a number of these things. I should have mentioned that this woman had a normal mammogram but had a 5-centimeter tumor that was palpated and actually seen in ultrasound. So first question is in terms of imaging, particularly in breast imaging, Aditya, particularly in younger patients.
The mammogram is good and has saved a number of lives, but it's not perfect. There are patients who can have negative mammograms but still have breast cancer. And we see this in patients who have lobular disease, and also patients who are young, because they can have dense breast tissue, which can hide an occult mass. And in this setting, the use of a breast MRI can be very valuable. So at our institution, we routinely get reports. If a patient has dense breast tissue, we get the recommendation, consider a breast MRI. So for a young patient, I think that is something that should definitely be considered.
All right, let's go on to the next case. This is a 60-year-old woman who's a Jehovah's Witness, has metastatic triple-negative disease, PD-1 positive. She has this patient, Dr. Jasani, massive chest wall disease, also mediastinal involvement, pleural effusion. She gets a NAB, atezolizumab with minimal response, and then goes on to sacituzumab. Here's Dr. Jasani.
She progressed with massive right chest wall disease into the right breast, which was a reconstructed breast. She had mediastinal lymph node, supraclavicular lymph node, and a right pleural effusion. She actually had PD-L1 greater than 1, and I treated her with the atezolizumab nab-paclitaxel regimen. She had minimal response and continued to progress, and I switched her over to sacituzumab and did get a clinical and radiographic response.
Any side effects from the sacituzumab?
Main side effect has only been neutropenia, well controlled with growth factors. Some fatigue, but significant clinical improvement from the sacituzumab because of the disease control. Her right chest wall from her clavicle down to her breast had a significant swelling and asymmetrical defect. A lot of that swelling and chest wall on clinical exam has reduced. Palpable areas have all reduced.
So, Aditya, before we talk about sacituzumab, there was a comment in the chat room, and actually relevant to this patient who got nab-tezo, kind of what happened with atezo.
And we don't have data that there's value in continuing immunotherapy beyond the first setting, and even data of sacituzumab plus immunotherapy, that's something that's being investigated in clinical trials. So for this patient, I think the regimen that was selected was the right one, which is sacituzumab govitecan as a single agent till we get additional data.
My question is, what happened with the approval for atezo in triple negative metastatic first line?
Now we've seen withdrawal of atezolizumab approval in the first line setting. The initial approval was an accelerated approval based on what was seen with PFS and OS as well, but this was contingent on confirmatory trials. And the subsequent confirmatory trial, which was a slightly different setting, was looking at paclitaxel rather than nab-paclitaxel, was essentially negative. So earlier this year, the company voluntarily withdrew the approval of atezolizumab. So at this time, there's only one immunotherapy agent that's FDA approved in the metastatic setting, and that's pembrolizumab.
So a bit about sacituzumab. You were very much involved in the study that led to its approval. I was mentioning in the introduction that we're talking about it all the time now, metastatic bladder cancer, where it's also approved. Can you first of all talk a little bit about the side effect profile? There's also a follow-up letter to the editor from your New England Journal paper asking about pulmonary issues and pneumonitis with sacituzumab. Any comment on that? This patient required some growth factor support. Is that typical of what you see?
In terms of side effects from sacituzumab govitecan, we have to look at the molecule. It's an antibody drug conjugate. The antibody is against TROP2, and that's conjugated to SN38, which is the toxic payload. So most of the side effects we see are side effects that we would expect from irinotecan because of SN38. So diarrhea, myelosuppression, alopecia, those are common side effects that we see with sacituzumab govitecan. In terms of pneumonitis, there are some reports that irinotecan can cause pneumonitis. We've not seen it so far with sacituzumab govitecan, be it in the phase 1, phase 2 trial, or even in the ASCENT trial. So far, we've not seen any pneumonitis with sacituzumab govitecan, but the team is also doing post-marketing surveillance. And if in the future pneumonitis is seen, I'm sure that'll be reported.
You describe a number of toxicity issues associated with chemotherapy, and this is an antibody drug conjugate, and a lot of us are used to thinking about antibody drug conjugates as Trojan horses that don't really have systemic effects. But I started to hear that with TDXD, that maybe more tolerability issues than, for example, TDM1. Can you give us some idea sort of where sacituzumab fits in terms of this issue?
If you think of antibody drug conjugates, particularly in breast cancer, we tend to think of TDM1, and that's an antibody drug conjugate which predominantly delivers the toxic payload to the cancer cells and does not have much what is called bystander effect. So you're talking about the Trojan horse, the army stays inside the city. But with these newer ADCs, the army can actually go out. It's the bystander effect. The toxic payload is membrane permeable. Or with sacituzumab govitecan, the linker is hydrolyzable. So once bulk of the antibody drug conjugate reaches the tumor or the tumor microenvironment, because of the hydrolyzable linker, SN38 can be released in the tumor microenvironment. The big advantage of that from a control perspective is that it can address HER2 heterogeneity. You're talking about trastuzumab deruxtecan that has shown efficacy in the so-called HER2 low tumors. We know TDM1 does not have efficacy in the HER2 low tumors. And that's largely, I think, because of this bystander effect, where if there's HER2 heterogeneity or TROP2 heterogeneity, because of this bystander effect, these drugs can even affect cells that do not express that antigen. The downside are the side effects. The SN38 can then go into the bloodstream and can cause side effects that we usually see with irinotecan, with the myelosuppression and the diarrhea.
What about efficacy? Again, you know, we look at the curves, we look at the waterfall plots, but, you know, it's kind of hard to get a real feel. A lot of docs haven't used the drug at all. What have you observed in clinically in terms of efficacy, onset of action, depth of response, duration of response, not so much the trial data, but your own experience and talking to your colleagues?
Yeah, my experience is very similar to what was mentioned in the case earlier. Patients usually have a response early on, even patients who've not had disease control with standard chemotherapy or immunotherapy. The median time to response is within 8 weeks. So by the time you get your first restaging scans, usually you can see a response, and majority of patients have some degree of response. In terms of duration of response, it can be variable. In the phase one, phase two trial, it ranged from 6 to 12 months, usually in that range in terms of duration of response. And then finally, in terms of depth of response, that's very variable. From a biomarker perspective, we're trying to understand what determines the depth of response. Why does a patient have 20% reduction versus someone who has 80% reduction? So from a research perspective, that's an interesting question that's being worked on.
Raji in the chat room wants to know if you check UGT1A and any other mutations before using sacituzumab.
So I'll answer the mutations first and then UGT1A. Mutations, no. We did subset analysis in ASCENT looking at patients who had germline BRCA mutation. And in that subgroup, we could see benefit with sacituzumab, govitecan, and also in patients who had BRCA wild type. So there's no specific mutation per se that determines the response or lack of response to sacituzumab govitecan that we know of so far. In terms of UGT1A1, it's a very interesting question. UGT1A1 polymorphisms are involved in metabolism of SN38. And because sacituzumab govitecan has SN38 backbone, the hypothesis was that patients who have UGT1A1 polymorphisms, the 2828 phenotype, would have more side effects. And when we look at the ASCENT trial, we see a trend that patients who have UGT1A1 polymorphisms are more likely to have febrile neutropenia. So particularly myelosuppression appears to be higher in patients who have UGT1A1 polymorphisms. Whether it's something that should be used in clinic, I would say probably not, because if a patient has myelosuppression, you can dose reduce. So rather than waiting for the results or sending this expensive test, you could start with the standard dose of sacituzumab govitecan. And if a patient is having myelosuppression or prolonged myelosuppression, just go down the dose. Having said that, if for some other reason a patient has known UGT1A1 polymorphisms, particularly this 2828 allele, I would be prepared that this is a patient who's likely going to have more side effects, particularly myelosuppression.
So would you do preemptive dose reduction?
It's tough to start at a low dose in the metastatic setting because it's tough to treat metastatic triple negative breast cancer. So I would start at 10 milligram per kilogram, because even in this subgroup in the ASCENT trial, the incidence of febrile neutropenia was not 100%. It was a bit higher, but there could be a patient who does very well with growth factor support. So I would start with the standard dose, but just be very cautious and expect that this is a patient who needs more close monitoring.
Where do you see SASE, as Joyce O'Shaughnessy calls it? I love that nickname. Where do you see SASE heading in the future? Of course, in oncology, typically their patients are studied late stage disease. It's moved up earlier. But what about the strategy of combining IO and antibody drug conjugate like SASE? We're seeing IO plus chemo now, just recently cervical cancer, first line mets, previously head, neck, and lung cancer. And fortimab and bladder cancer being studied with IO. They're all excited about that. What are some of the new ideas for sacituzumab, Dr. Bardia, being studied in trials?
You know, you're exactly correct. So there are ongoing studies looking at sacituzumab govitecan plus immunotherapy in the first-line metastatic triple-negative breast cancer setting. There are also trials looking at sacituzumab govitecan in early breast cancer. Can we use it in the neoadjuvant or adjuvant setting to prevent metastatic disease? At our institution, we have a trial where we're looking at neoadjuvant sacituzumab govitecan as a single agent in the triple negative breast cancer setting. And that cohort is completed. And now we will be looking at sacituzumab govitecan plus immunotherapy. So looking at a combination of ADC plus IO.
So let's go back to our cases. And we have a patient from Dr. Ariel Heek, a 61-year-old lady with metastatic triple-negative breast cancer. This patient is also HRD positive and has an LOH score of 43%. And you can see TP53, RB1 mutations. The patient was treated with atezo-nab and had progressive disease. Currently getting pembro-carbo-gem with, I guess, a mixed response. But her question really is, again, one I've been hearing a lot about in terms of alterations other than BRCA, particularly in the metastatic setting, that will get you to consider a PARP inhibitor. Here's Dr. Hickey.
She had a response on exam, but unfortunately, when she went to surgery, she still had RCB3 disease, including additional involvement in the lymph nodes. She did receive 6 months of adjuvant capecitabine, and she began experiencing more swelling within the affected breast. And by the early fall, she also had pain. So her breast was ultimately biopsied and unfortunately showed Paget's disease of the breast or like an inflammatory recurrence of her triple negative breast cancer. Staging studies at that time showed small volume metastatic disease in the lungs, which was biopsied and confirmed that. What's interesting about her case is we did pursue molecular profiling, and she did have a positive HRD score and also a high LOH score. So it brought into the question a PARP inhibitor, which of course is not approved in this space, but in a patient who really has limited options and you've already essentially exhausted chemo and immunotherapy, you know, this at least is a unique approach. The only therapy that she really hasn't gotten that is unique would be sacituzumab, which because of the toxicity concern, she, you know, reads about it on message boards. She's told me absolutely not. So we'll see.
I was really surprised by that last statement. You wonder how often we see patients who are maybe getting poor information. I don't know. Is that something you've seen incidentally? I was kind of surprised at that, Aditya, coming in saying, no, I don't want to get sacituzumab. I can see saying I'm going to get chemo, but what about sacituzumab?
No, I would agree. I was surprised as well. If you look at the percentage of discontinuation in the ASCENT trial, the percentage of discontinuation with sacituzumab govitecan was very low, like about 2%. And that's what we've seen in the phase 1, phase 2 trial as well. And we feel comfortable with the drug. And that's why it got moved to the neoadjuvant setting. So I'm a bit surprised as well. And I think we have to be careful about what's said in the message boards and as oncologists talk to patients and provide reliable information related to the efficacy as well as side effects.
So what about her main question here? We were talking before in terms of the early stage setting, the Olympia situation, but this is metastatic disease previously treated. Assuming you can access a PARP inhibitor, how wide is your net? Somatic mutations, germline mutations, PALB2, and this is really interesting with this LOH and HRD. Of course, in ovary, you know, they're looking at every single thing they can think about, although everybody ends up getting a PARP inhibitor anyhow. But what about metastatic breast cancer, Dr. Bardia?
Yeah, I would make 2 points. The first related to LOH, it's very interesting. It would be important to look at the tissue that was sent for analysis. Was it a metastatic specimen or was it a primary breast cancer specimen? In the TNT trial and other trials, they've seen this as well, that HRD is more like a genomic scar. Once it's present, it's always present, but does not necessarily mean that this specific patient would respond to PARP inhibition or carboplatin, particularly in the later line setting. So I would be a bit careful with the use of HRD, particularly if the specimen was an archival specimen. The second thing relates to the type of mutation, and this has been investigated in clinical trials with olaparib, where Nadine Tung and her group, through the TBCRC study, looked at different mutations besides germline BRCA and response to PARP inhibition. There were essentially two mutations where responses with olaparib were seen, the first being somatic BRCA mutation and the second being PALB2. So if a patient has somatic BRCA or PALB2, be germline or somatic, I feel comfortable with the use of PARP inhibitor. Outside of that, I would usually try to look for a clinical trial. So even if a drug is used, it's done in a systematic fashion.
So let's go into another case, and it's really amazing. I hear so many cases, and yet every day I hear things I've never heard of before. I have never heard of anything about what you're about to hear. So you've probably seen three of these, but anyhow, Dr. Madhani has a 55-year-old lady with metastatic triple-negative breast cancer, PD-1 positive. The thing that was so unusual is when she said it, I was like, what? The patient had a strong hypersensitivity reaction to atezo. In other words, that's her conclusion. You can tell me whether you agree or not. And then they, of course, stopped the atezo. They rechallenged her again, had the same thing happen. And here's her question. Here's Dr. Matani.
I saw her as a second opinion, but apparently her oncologist gave her nab-paclitaxel and atezolizumab based on the IMPASSION data, and she had a pretty bad hypersensitivity reaction to the atezo. She hadn't been pre-medicated prior to the treatment, and they decided to re-challenge her with pre-meds, and again, she had a pretty strong reaction, and it was permanently discontinued, but the decision was made to continue the nab-paclitaxel alone.
So I'm not too sure I've heard much about either hypersensitivity or infusion reactions to atezo.
So I wasn't with her when she had the reaction, but from what I heard her describe and her physician, it was during the actual infusion she had a reaction. And I looked it up and I saw that infusion-related reactions occurred in about 1.3% of patients receiving atezo as a single agent. Grade 3 reactions were really rare, less than 1%. So my thought was to re-challenge with pembrolizumab and gemcarbo. And my question would be if this is something that other investigators would feel comfortable doing in a patient that had a pretty strong infusion reaction to one of the other agents, like in this case, atezo.
So the patient comes to you for a second opinion, says, Dr. Matani wants to give me an IO and I had this terrible reaction. What are your thoughts?
That's a tough question. And to be honest, I've never seen something like this before. I think things to consider would be, should the same IO be used? Can we switch to a different type of IO and maybe there would not be cross-reactivity in terms of a reaction? The second would be discussion with allergy. We've seen reactions to chemotherapy, reactions to trastuzumab, reactions to T-DM1. And in the adjuvant setting, we admit patients so they can have desensitization and get the therapy that could potentially be life-saving. So I would talk to allergy and consider a desensitization protocol if it's clear that immunotherapy is really beneficial for this patient.
So here's the follow-up on this patient. So what's her current situation?
Currently, she started gemcitabine, carboplatin, and pembrolizumab. She's had 2 doses. She hasn't had any reaction, and she's starting to have some regression of some of the tumor nodules outside of the radiation field. She hopefully will do okay for a while. It seems very aggressive disease. But at this point, given the fact that she's really not responded well to multiple agents and she does have PD-L1 positivity, and we know that there are certain patients that are going to have a response to immunotherapy, I was inclined to re-challenge her with one of the other drugs. And so far, so good.
I guess you could say, any thoughts about that?
No, that's fantastic. And in the metastatic setting, if a patient is having response to a drug, you know, we try everything we can to see if we can keep the patient on the drug, because we know otherwise, you know, it's a very difficult disease to treat.
So I want to show a couple of answers from the poll we did of the faculty, and then I want to show some papers that you were involved with. Here's a pretty practical question, which is, how do you give pembro? And you can see a lot of the faculty is into Q6 weeks. Any thoughts? So you say Q6 weeks right up front. You don't even start with, looks like most of the other faculty starts with Q3 weeks. I've heard people claim, I don't know if it's true or not, that they see more nonspecific immune problems when they give the higher dose every 6 weeks. Any comments, Dr. Bardia?
Yeah, the reason I mentioned Q6 week is if we look at the half-life and the data we've seen from other non-breast cancer setting, the antibodies stay in the system for a while. And so from a pharmacokinetic perspective, Q6 week is very reasonable. I mentioned Q6 even in neoadjuvant because we tend to many times use dose-dense AC. So if you're giving AC every 2 weeks and then the immunotherapy is every 3 weeks. Essentially, it's every week that the patient is coming in. And especially during the COVID times, you know, we were trying to decrease the number of visits to the hospital. But with Q6 weeks, things tend to align much better.
So actually, Hassan in the chat room brings up an interesting point that you do see hypersensitivity with avelumab, that particular IO. It's not that common, but that's interesting. Another question, this actually a couple of people have asked in the chat room, is if you're using the neoadjuvant adjuvant pembro strategy, do you still use capecitabine with residual disease? And you can see the faculty's answer. You say yes, but a couple other people say, you know, more high risk situations. Dr. Vogel also says yes. Anything you want to add to that, Dr. Bardia?
Yeah, I would just emphasize we have safety data with capecitabine plus immunotherapy. So for the right patient, if you're worried about disease recurrence, you want to use the best agents you have. I would feel very comfortable with capecitabine plus pembro.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the work you've been involved with. Beginning with this first paper it's going to be presented at San Antonio, another antibody-drug conjugate with a familiar last name. What's the difference between this and sacituzumab?
Yeah, datopotamab deruxtecan or Dato-DXd is also a TROP2 antibody-drug conjugate. We presented the results in triple-negative breast cancer earlier at ESMO. Breast ESMO and at San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium will have updated results. The difference with sacituzumab govitecan essentially is the payload. The payload with datopotamab deruxtecan is deruxtecan, which is also TOPO1 isomerase inhibitor, but is much more potent than SN38. The second difference is the type of linker. Datopotamab deruxtecan has a linker which is different from sacituzumab govitecan, which is a hydrolyzable linker. So the antibody drug conjugate, while it targets TROP2, the linker and the type of payload are different.
So thinking about that also, again, we're not talking too much about TDXD today, but just kind of curious, again, with the updated data now in the second line, we talked about that with Erica. What are your thoughts right now? And again, I don't know if this is going to be an issue with this product of interstitial lung disease. It looks like now as the trials are, you know, more recent, that you're seeing less interstitial lung disease. How does that relate to the payload? Why do you think we see that here? And what do you think the future is in terms of, you know, modifying or ameliorating this problem?
Yeah, absolutely. With trastuzumab deruxtecan, pneumonitis was of concern, but as oncologists are getting more familiar with A, recognizing pneumonitis early, and B, intervening early, the incidence of severe grade 3 or higher pneumonitis has definitely decreased. And we see that from DESTINY-Breast03 trial, where the pneumonitis incidence was much, much less as compared to DESTINY-Breast01. In terms of whether datopotamab deruxtecan also causes pneumonitis, we've not seen it so far in breast cancer. Having said that, it has been described in lung cancer. And if you look at the development of this drug, in terms of dose escalation, it went up to 8 milligram per kilogram, and I think even 10 milligram per kilogram. And that's where they were seeing pneumonitis. So the dose that's being developed in breast cancer is 6 milligram per kilogram. And maybe at that dose, the incidence of pneumonitis would be lower, even 0%.
We were talking about eligibility to receive PARP inhibitors. And I love the trial in progress posters in all these meetings. And I see you have one phase 2 study looking at cell-free DNA and somatic BRCA mutations. What's the thinking behind this, and how often do you see positive cell-free DNA showing this?
Yeah, this work is actually an investigator-initiated trial based on prior work we had done. We looked at our experience in our institution of patients who were getting plasma-based genotyping and found that about 7% or so of patients have detectable somatic BRCA mutations. And patients, when they have somatic BRCA mutation, potentially could have therapeutic response with PARP inhibition. We did some preclinical work with the lab and had a cell line with somatic BRCA mutation. And in that cell line, you could see that PARP inhibitor was effective. So this led to this investigator-initiated trial where we're looking at telazoparib as the preferred PARP inhibitor for patients who have somatic BRCA mutation.
So to me, 7% sounds pretty high. I mean, NTRK and all these other things we look for are a lot less than that. So that's really exciting. I want to ask you about this next paper here. We were talking about capecitabine for residual disease. And this is, I thought this was really interesting. paper looking at how it actually plays out in the so-called real world, the CREATE-X. Looked like it maybe wasn't as great as the trial. What were your thoughts?
No, exactly. So CREATE-X was done in the Asian Japanese population. And we know in the US population, the tolerability to capecitabine is much lower. The hypothesis is it's related to folate in the diet, which makes it more difficult to tolerate capecitabine. The incidence of hand-foot syndrome is much higher. And the dose that's recommended, at least as per CREATE-X trial, is just not feasible in the US. So we wanted to look at our experience, and we saw that A number of patients needed dose reduction, and B, the recurrence was much higher than what was seen in CREATE-X. So whether we would be able to replicate the CREATE-X results in the US population, I'm not sure, but this paper does raise concern that capecitabine might not be as effective as was seen in CREATE-X in the US population.
And actually, I think I'm wrong. This wasn't real world. This is your patients, right? MGH?
That's correct.
That's interesting. When we talk about this dilemma, whether to, you know, keep it going, maybe it's not as great as we thought. So several papers on sacituzumab that we were talking about, but I'm just curious about this neoadjuvant, again, trial in progress. In addition, for clinical response rate, et cetera, any biologic translational things you're looking for there?
The NeoSTAR trial is looking at neoadjuvant sacituzumab, and it's an adaptive trial design. So patients start with sacituzumab govitecan, 4 cycles. And if a patient still has residual disease, after sacituzumab govitecan is completed, patients can get additional neoadjuvant therapy, and that could be AC, or it could be taxane, or it could be carbotaxane. But in a patient who has complete response to sacituzumab govitecan, they can proceed to surgery. And if they have a PCR, then it's a discussion with the patient. So the whole idea is escalation, de-escalation, looking at response to sacituzumab govitecan, and then after that, escalating therapy or de-escalating therapy. From a biomarker perspective, patients get biopsy before and at the end of completion of sacituzumab govitecan. So we're trying to identify predictive biomarkers as well as biomarkers associated with resistance.
Is there sort of a Catherine-like trial also approaching using sacituzumab post-neoadjuvant chemo for residual disease?
That's exactly correct. And the trial is called SACIA. It's not open in US, it's in Europe. And that's a trial for patients who have residual disease after standard neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Patients are randomized to either receive sacituzumab govitecan or adjuvant platinum or capecitabine.
So I want to ask you also, you had several papers, and I can remember, it seems like so long ago, I guess it was only a year and a half ago, as the pandemic was starting, I was really talking a lot to people in New York and Boston. Those are the two areas, at least from the medical point of view in particular, that were really getting hit early. And in a way, I was looking back at these papers here, and it almost, this is all like of historic interest at this point, even though it was only more than a year ago. Just curious for your reflection, some of the stories I heard. We work with Kelly Goodwin, the nurse practitioner who set up a COVID oncology unit at MGH. And I know you all were out there taking care of COVID patients who didn't even have cancer. Any reflections back to that time, Dr. Bardia?
I think the three broad reflections. First, it highlighted the need to be flexible and look at all the evidence you have. We had a CPC that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which was for a patient who was 60 year old and had a 2.5 centimeter hormone receptor positive tumor. We would just do surgery, but we couldn't do surgery at that time. So the team had to be creative and come up with a therapy that could keep her disease under control till the patient could get surgery. And we felt that chemotherapy was maybe too much, and we started with neoadjuvant endocrine therapy. And in general, in the US, we've not been using much neoadjuvant endocrine therapy, but I can bet last year the usage of neoadjuvant endocrine therapy increased quite a bit. The second reflection was how we need to work as a team. We were all called in to cover the COVID floors, and I was taking care of patients who didn't have cancer. It reminded me of my med school residency days again. And the thing that was striking was the spirit of teamwork. You know, all of us in the same room, taking care of patients, supporting each other. So this, the importance of teamwork was again highlighted during the COVID pandemic. And the third is there's light at the end of the tunnel. At that time, it was just impossible to see through the fog. But now if we look back, you know, things have improved. They're not back to baseline as compared to how they were 3 years ago, but still things have improved. So as they say, this too shall pass. And that's the third reflection that I have.
Yeah, again, I've always loved the New England Journal, you know, a case approach, grand rounds. And you had this case and there was all this long discussion about how you were, just as you were talking about, how you were modifying your approaches early on in the pandemic. Everybody was kind of thinking about that. And as you say, this too has sort of passed or beginning to pass. One more paper and topic I wanted to bring up, because so many oncologists bring this up to me and I still am not really clear about it. Circulating tumor DNA, everybody's all excited about it. You've studied that and a lot of liquid approaches to detecting genomic abnormalities. Can you talk a little bit about how you see this applying to breast cancer? And right now, what kind of assay, if any, could a doc in practice order that might help them?
We had a lot of discussion about 5-6 years ago when we were starting to use genotyping, particularly plasma-based genotyping. So we did a project where we looked at patients who got plasma-based genotyping and matched therapy versus patients who didn't get matched therapy based on plasma-based genotyping. And we found that patients who got matched therapy based on plasma-based genotyping had an improvement in overall survival. So that was a high level of evidence to us that plasma-based genotyping can improve survival. There is some clinical value in ordering plasma-based genotyping. And that addressed some of the concern that some of the members in our group had. In terms of what to use and where to use it, I would say definitely in the hormone receptor positive metastatic breast cancer setting, because we have a drug, alpelisib, that's FDA approved for PIK3CA mutant hormone receptor positive breast cancer. So you want to know whether an individual patient has PIK3CA mutation or not, because it's actionable.
So, you know, is this going to be those sort of, can this be sort of an MRD, sort of PSA tumor marker thing that people can use in the post-adjuvant, post-neoadjuvant setting to make decisions about whether to use or continue therapy?
That's an area of active research. We have ongoing studies, including studies at our institution, exactly looking at this question. Can we look at circulating tumor DNA in the adjuvant setting to detect MRD and then intervene to potentially prevent metastases? We know that tumor markers are not sensitive enough, and this was studied in the past where if you follow tumor markers in the adjuvant setting and you detect cancer early, it really doesn't change outcomes. But how about the use of more sensitive assays so that the lead time is much more? That's something that's being investigated.